All right. So I've been sitting with this idea all week, the story we're about to tell. And I keep coming back to the same question. Why does the domestic space, of all places, become the most terrifying when something is just slightly off?
That's exactly where Freud starts, actually. His 1919 essay, The Uncanny, Das Unheimliche in German, makes this precise argument. The sensation isn't triggered by the alien or the monstrous. It's triggered by something familiar that has been repressed and then returns. The home is the most intimate space we have, so when it betrays us, the effect is visceral.
So not 99% alien, 99% familiar.
Exactly. And that 1% wrong is what does the damage. Now, before we get into the philosophy, our listener needs to feel this first. So let's step into the story. Close your eyes if it helps. This is Elias Thorne.
Elias is 38. He works in municipal water planning, the kind of job that keeps a city alive and earns almost no recognition for it. He lives in a mid-sized house on Carver Street with his partner, Sarah, no children, a dog named Pepper, who died 2 years ago and is still somehow missed every single morning.
It's a life that fits him like a worn coat. Comfortable, predictable. And then one Tuesday, he walks into the kitchen and the mugs are on the wrong shelf. Not dramatically wrong, just moved. The blue one is where the white one should be.
He asks Sarah about it that evening. She looks at him with that particular patience that long-term partners develop and says, "Elias, they've always been like that." And she believes it. He can see that she believes it.
That moment is the key idea here, because now Elias has two contradictory realities. His memory says one thing, the physical world and his partner say another. That's cognitive dissonance in its most intimate form, the mental discomfort of holding two contradictory beliefs simultaneously and not being able to dismiss either one.
So what does he do? Most people would just let it go, right?
Most people would. And Elias tries, but then it happens again. He finds a photograph on the bookshelf, him and Sarah at a lake house. He has no memory of that trip, none. He asks Sarah, and she describes the whole weekend in detail. The drive, the rain, the restaurant with the bad wine.
Wait, but couldn't that just be a memory gap? People forget things.
That's the rational exit, yes. And Elias takes it, for a while. But here's where the sociologist Anthony Giddens becomes relevant. Giddens coined the term ontological security, our sense of continuity and order in our environment and identity. It's not just psychological comfort. It's the scaffolding that makes a coherent self possible. When that scaffolding starts to crack, the self doesn't just feel confused, it feels threatened at its foundation.
So Elias isn't just forgetting things. He's losing the ground he stands on.
Right. But how does that escalate? Because so far this could still be stress, or early memory issues, or just the ordinary drift of a long relationship where two people remember things differently.
It escalates because of the jacket. Elias finds a jacket in the hall closet, his size, his style, but with a school play program tucked in the pocket. A child's name printed on it. Milo Thorne, age 7, playing the Tin Man. Elias and Sarah do not have a child.
And that's the moment the story shifts from unsettling to genuinely destabilizing. Because a jacket can't be misremembered into existence. A printed program with a child's name, his surname, is physical evidence. It either belongs to a life he has no access to, or it belongs to a life he has somehow forgotten entirely.
Think of it this way. If memory is the primary anchor of personal identity, what happens when physical evidence contradicts that memory? Is Elias still Elias, or is he standing at the edge of someone else's life?
That's where philosopher David Lewis enters the picture. Lewis proposed what he called counterpart theory, the idea that in alternate possible worlds, there isn't literally you living a different life. There's a counterpart, someone who resembles you in significant ways, shares your history up to a branching point, but is a distinct individual. The unsettling implication for Elias is this: what if the jacket belongs to his counterpart? And what if that counterpart's life somehow bled through?
Or, and this is the reading that keeps me up at night, what if Elias is the counterpart? What if the life with Milo is the original, and this life, the one without the child, is the branch?
And there's no clean way to answer that from inside the experience. That's the trap. Elias walks to the end of Carver Street that night, and there it is, a house, same layout as his, same paint, same porch light. But through the window, drawings on the refrigerator, small shoes by the door. A life that is his and isn't his, running parallel, just out of reach.
The takeaway from this first part of the story, and remember, we're not resolving it yet, is that the uncanny works precisely because it doesn't announce itself. It arrives in the mugs, the photograph, the jacket. It uses the furniture of ordinary life as its evidence.
And for everyone sitting with this story right now, the question to hold is not what is the explanation. The question is, what would it take for the evidence to become undeniable? And what would you do with a self that might not be the only version of itself? As Elias stands before that house, the boundaries of his world begin to fray. Next, we follow him inside, and our hosts take over to ask what philosophy actually makes of a life that branches.